The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
Anton Savage, I believe you are on the line there somewhere on a street in Dublin with a bucket and your charm.
No, that and the Euro get me on a bus. For the first time, I'm actually missing my Patrick from SpongeBob outfit because it's a chilly top of Grafton Street. The wind would cut through you. But fair play to the guys from Make-A-Wish, and specifically fair play to the guys from Loretto on the Green and from SEI, because they have provided people to go shaking buckets all the way around the town this morning. They're going to be out and about through until 6 o'clock this afternoon trying to raise money, and particularly fair play to SEI, because SEI are going to match whatever is given. So they are a doubling up corporate sponsor. You give money, they will match what is given. And while I'm saying fair play, Kira, can I also say fair play to people who work for the Lewis? Because just standing here and watching, every person who has walked past wearing a Lewis orange high-vis vest and a Lewis jumper has given something to them. So in terms of most generous public sector workers thus far, the Lewis are showing everybody up. But there's a couple of guards coming up the road, so we'll see if they put their hands in their pockets.
Give me a sound of that bucket there, Anton. How are you getting on? What have you managed to gather so far? And what's the reaction been from people are passing? Are they putting their hands in their pocket?
Kira, you're living in the past. This whole bucket thing. I mean, yes, they do have buckets. So if there are traditionalists who want to actually give cash, but if you're one of those people who sees people gathering, collecting on the street, and you think, oh God, I don't carry cash anymore, I'd better leg it. Don't worry. Make-A-Wish, not only are they giving great wishes, they're fierce sophisticated in their technology. So everybody here is equipped with a smartphone, and that smartphone will take contactless payments. So never mind your bucket shaking, they are getting digital payments, and they are doing very well thus far. There's a lot of very generous people coming past them. And what they're going to do now in the next about 10 minutes is the guys from SEI and the guys from Loretto are going to disperse around to a couple of key locations on King Street, on Grafton Street, down towards Dawson Street and all the way. So if you are in the centre of Dublin today and you see somebody wearing a Make-A-Wish bib, carrying a blue bucket and carrying a smartphone, do feel free to donate. And of course, don't forget, Kira, as you'll be saying throughout the morning, makeawish.ie/donate if people want to do it from the comfort of their own home.
All right, Anton, we will let you go back, collect a little bit more money, get out that little tap machine. There's no excuse, as you say, for people who don't, like me, carry any change anymore. We really do appreciate those donations, and there will be bucket collectors, I think, right around the country this morning. We really want to make 2026 the biggest wish week yet. Every single cent matters. And as Anton says, you can donate online at makeawish.ie/donate. It's such a positive story. It's one that's full of hope. And I think it's a good time to bring in our next guest, who's the author, journalist and broadcaster, John Kampfner, who's here to talk about his new book, Braver New World, The Countries Daring to Do Things Others Won't. You're very welcome to the programme, John. So this book, right, is looking at issues that governments right across the world grapple with every single day. What to do with an ageing population, how to turn what's a crisis for many countries into something to be celebrated, how to get a health service that works, that functions for people efficiently and isn't just a black hole for money. And what you have done here, rather than being pessimistic about how governments are succeeding, you've gone around the world and you've found models of excellence, those countries that really are onto something. Why, for you, John, was this the right time to write this book?
Good morning. I mean, therapy was the main reason. I had become a professional pessimist. I mean, since 2016, with the great Brexit nightmare that afflicted the UK, and then came Donald Trump, and I expected Marine Le Pen would win in France. And it's gone from bad to worse in so many places. And I realized that it's quite easy to report about that. It's quite easy to report about strongmen, about the decline of democracy, how everything is going pear-shaped. But how about looking for whatever alternatives there are? Because if we as Western liberal democracies, to use that catch-all phrase, cannot learn to govern better, to deliver more, to include the people more, and to produce better outcomes, then we are toast, we are finished, and we deserve to be. And so that's what I was doing. I was going to, as you say, I was going to 10 countries and cities, not necessarily excellence, because excellence suggests that everything is wonderful, it's all delivered, everything is fine. And that doesn't exist anywhere. But these are countries, governments, peoples, communities who are doing their best, and they are showing three things that I think are absolutely central to all forms of governing: courage, resilience, and imagination. And when you look at where I am based in Germany, there's been precious little of it previously, certainly under Olaf Scholz. In Britain, it's reeling under the paralysis and hyper-caution of Keir Starmer. And there is some really interesting good practice out there.
We have had just a week of unrest here in this country. There were protests right across Ireland, and a lot of people, I think, feeling disenfranchised, feeling fed up with elements of Irish society and feeling the government isn't doing enough for people in this country. But you have covered lots of heated moments on a global scale right across your career. Do you feel like we're at a more dangerous time now than ever? Or do you feel, looking back at your career, that regardless of what era people live in, there will always be these dangerous moments?
Well, in a way, I think it's both of those things. There have always been. I've been incredibly privileged. I mean, I covered the fall of the Berlin Wall, the collapse of communism. I've covered some pretty horrific wars, the run-up to the road to the Iraq War, the financial crash. There's so much that has happened, and there's never been an era without wars, without conflict, without people thinking everything's terrible. But we've had 80 years post-war, post-Second World War, of the post-war settlement of international institutions, broadly the rule of law, although often flouted. And you get a sense that it is coming to an end. And Donald Trump is the embodiment of that, but not the only one. But it's really in our gift to build something. And you know, the Irish situation is a fascinating one. And so much of it, to use the jargon, it's about input legitimacy. It's about people wanting to feel included. So a couple of very quick examples. In Canada, everywhere immigration is a hot, burning political issue. What they have done in Canada, and they've made mistakes along the way, is to bring the people along with them. The original population sponsors migrants. You could be a community, you could be a church group, a company, a family, whatever. And you say, we want to bring in these people to do this particular work, or to work in our particular hospital, or because they're being persecuted, whatever. And you take responsibility. And that's a remarkable thing. You are literally responsible for them in the first year. So immigration isn't something that is done to people who just passively stand back and see it happen. In Finland, education isn't something where kids just say, right, sit down, shut up, you know, write this down and learn by rote, which is pretty much the situation. I mean, I paraphrase, but that's pretty much the situation in the UK. You don't have testing of schools. You almost have no testing of pupils. What you have is a system of responsibility, where schools are responsible for their output, where teachers are responsible for their output, and where pupils and their parents help to curate the lessons that they learn. So they learn stuff around democracy, about how to start a business, about how to tell fake news from from facts that you can rely on. All these life skills, particularly now with the onset of AI and with so many dangers facing us, are absolutely central. So it is a sort of different kind of relationship between state and individual, because the way we have been carrying on for the last several years, really since the financial crash, is clearly not delivering for people.
When you describe it there, it sounds like a really mature way of governing. What I noticed from your book, and it's divided into chapters looking at a number of issues, as I said, aging or education or the health service and these models of excellence, is that the UK doesn't appear, the US doesn't appear, Ireland certainly doesn't appear, and often these models are existing in quite unlikely places.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So it's deliberately. I mean, I did a book a few years ago, 6 years ago, called Why the Germans Do It Better. And that was looking at the political maturity of this country, which I still think, in spite of its failings, exists. And I was contrasting that with clown Britain of Boris Johnson and buffoonery and everything else. It was a period that I felt deeply humiliated to be a Brit, and now I'm partly a Brit and a German. But no, this is a message to the big G7 countries, particularly a message to the Americans, which that country is as close to a failing state in terms of politics and the way it is governed and political corruption and financial corruption as you can find. It's a message to America, it's a message to Britain, it's a message to France, it's a message to Germany and to others to say, stop lecturing people so much. Mm. Stop waving the flag and saying, aren't we doing well? And just you follow us. And actually show some humility and learn from others. Because some of my examples, you know, the obvious thing when you're looking at best practice and you look at lists put up by the UN or OECD, is it's always the Nordics. It's the Scandinavians and maybe the Swiss and the Dutch and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, I went to Morocco to look at renewable energy, Costa Rica to look at sustainability. Taiwan is a fascinating case. It is a brilliant health service. You get triaged, you get seen by a specialist on average 20 minutes after arriving in a clinic, and it spends far less than any of our countries in terms of per capita GDP on health. So how are they achieving it? Well, they're achieving it by individuals taking responsibility for their health and having far more health literacy. So I wanted to include countries that are a complete surprise.
The book is described as an antidote to fatalism and gloom. And there was one chapter within the book that I really enjoyed. It actually put a smile on my face yesterday. And it is the chapter about Japan and how they are dealing with an aging population. They are soon to have 500 million people living in Japan who are over 100 years of age. And one of the lovely, lovely stories that you had within that was how they are bringing young and old people together in sort of multi-generational houses that are just working for everybody. Can you tell us about that?
So this is a town not far from Yokohama, the port, about an hour. I mean, the trains, as everybody knows in Japan, are so amazing, so it never takes you long to get anywhere. But it's about an hour outside, just to the south of Tokyo. And it's a village community on the edge of this town where everybody in different generations are living together. So you have a lot of elderly people, people with dementia or not with dementia, in some buildings, and you have people with children. And so the kids walk home down the lane from school and come in and pop in and say hello to everybody. And in one particular building, you have university students who live on the floor above, because obviously they're more physically mobile. And they receive subsidized rent for their student accommodation. In return, on their way to and from classes, they are supposed to knock on the door, ring the bell of the elderly person or people that are in their purview, that are in their sort of their block or their area, and to check that they're all right, wish them good morning, maybe, you know, boil the kettle for them, whatever. They do the same in the evening. Once in a while on a Saturday afternoon, they run tea parties for the elderly, and it's all mixed together.
Yeah, and it all just sounds lovely and joyous and functional.
Yeah, I mean, what works to me is this mixture of behaving well, ethics, morality, principle, whatever you want to call it, but also self-interest. And, you know, it's obviously, if you don't have much money as a student, it's in your self-interest to have cheaper accommodation. And the quid pro quo is just to be nice and caring and helpful to the elderly. So you could build these kinds of models anyway. And they are actually, they exist in Spain and Holland and other places too.
Yeah, and but if they as you say, it requires courage. I think you said resilience and imagination. And sometimes those qualities are kind of hard to come by. It's a great book, John Kampfner. Thank you so much for speaking to us on the Claire Byrne Show this morning. And still,
the Claire Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.